I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, March 10th on CBC Radio. Aid urgency in Gaza and growing starvation amid the Israel-Hamas war. We'll bring you analysis on the latest in this ongoing conflict first up. After that, hopping on a plane for a winter escape? Bruce Poon Tip wants you to think differently about taking that trip. The Canadian travel businessman will wax on the ethics of tourism in 2024. And this Oscar Sunday, Hollywood artists are getting their flowers for their achievement in film, but one group of talent will be noticeably absent: stunt workers. Our Sunday documentary shines a spotlight on the efforts to change that. And later on, discover the real story behind one of tonight's top Academy Award nominees, Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. The Islamic holy month of Ramadan is about to begin. That means observant Muslims across the world will soon be united in a daily ritual of fasting from sunrise to sunset. But this year, Ramadan will be marked against the backdrop of the Israel-Hamas war as this conflict enters its sixth month. And hope that the start of Ramadan might bring a new ceasefire has now faded, while warnings of famine in Gaza are becoming increasingly dire. Bijan Ahmadi is the executive director at the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy, a Canadian-American nonpartisan think tank specializing in international affairs. Nader Hashemi is a Canadian-American associate professor at Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University. Bijan and Nader, good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Thank you for being with us. Nader, you have taught and written extensively about Islamic politics and culture over your career. What sort of reflections are you having as a practicing Muslim on this start of Ramadan with this war in the backdrop?
Well, all eyes are focused on Gaza. This is just not a crisis for the Middle East, for the Islamic world, but it's indeed a global crisis. And it's a crisis that has been significantly enhanced by the policies of Western governments, including Canada, that have facilitated, I think, what is clearly one of, you know, the worst moral catastrophes that we've witnessed in the 21st century. Your listeners probably know these statistics, but they're worth reminding everyone that in the first 100 days of this conflict in Gaza, Israel dropped the kiloton equivalent of 3 nuclear bombs on the Gaza Strip, killing more than 24,000 people in the first 100 days, including more than 10,000 children. Those numbers now have increased to, you know, 30,000 people killed, over 12,000 children. And so as people, at least in the Muslim world, gathered together during Ramadan to pray, to worship, and to reflect on their moral responsibilities, at the height of that, I think moral responsibility is dealing with questions of gross injustice. And that puts, you know, Gaza really at the top of the list. So I think this is going to be a conversation that many Muslims around the world, including in Canada, are going to be talking about when they gather together to break, you know, fast at the end of the day.
Bijan, you know, for the past number of weeks, all eyes have sort of been on the start of Ramadan in the sense that there was hope among many. The U.S. President Joe Biden was one of them who said, you know, hoping that a ceasefire could be reached before Ramadan gets underway. Those talks are now pretty much at a standstill. They're still happening, but not much traction. What needs to happen to get diplomacy, to get negotiations, to get a second ceasefire going?
Well, what we're hearing right now from both sides is that, you know, they're blaming each other. But it seems that the main sticking point, the main issue, the main difference between the two sides is that Hamas wants a deal that ends the fighting permanently, and Israel does not want to concede that and does not only agrees to a temporary ceasefire that would see a release of some of the hostages. The numbers that they're talking about is about 40 hostages to be released, 400 Palestinians to be released from Israeli prisons as well, in return for 6 weeks of ceasefire, temporary ceasefire. However, Hamas is looking for an end of the fighting completely, permanently, and also for the Israeli forces to withdraw from Gaza, something that Israelis have said that they're not going to agree to. So that is one of the main issues. Are we going to see a change in the position of either of these parties? I doubt we're going to see Israelis agree to a permanent ceasefire at this point. So I'm not very optimistic about that change. But we know that the mediators, especially Egyptians and Qataris, especially Qataris, are putting pressure on Hamas to change its position and to agree to a ceasefire. There are reports that Qataris have even asked, have even told the Hamas leaders that they're going to expel them from Qatar if they do not agree to a ceasefire. So we should see in the coming hours, in the coming days, if these pressures are going to change Hamas's position with regards to these negotiations.
Nader, the current conflict began on October 7th when Hamas killed 1,200 people in Israel, took a couple hundred hostages back. We are told that there are still about 100 hostages being held inside Gaza. And so the other side of the sort of unofficial deadline of the start of Ramadan comes from Israel that said, you know, if Israeli hostages were not returned by today, that it would begin an offensive into Rafah, where we know hundreds of thousands of Gazans have been displaced to. Are these sort of, I don't know, somewhat arbitrary deadlines helpful or hurtful, especially when they're not met?
Well, I think they're not helpful, obviously, because they raise expectations that are then not met. And I'm thinking specifically of, you know, Palestinians in Gaza that you know, are in the firing line. I mean, we're talking about, let's not forget, when we have a conversation of Gaza, we're talking about a case of plausible genocide, according to the wording of the International Court of Justice. And so when these deadlines are announced, I think people on the ground in Gaza who are suffering horrific conditions, I think their hopes are elevated that perhaps there might be some light at the end of the tunnel. Perhaps the fighting will stop. Perhaps there will be more, you know, humanitarian aid arriving to stop the mass starvation and the misery that we've been seeing. And then those hopes, of course, are then dashed, just adding to the misery and the pain and the suffering that the people of Gaza are facing. And also that applies to, I think, other people on the Israeli side as well. We have to remember that the only way that some of the Israeli hostages were released was in the context of, you know, a ceasefire and negotiations that secured some of the hostages out. So people who have loved ones that are in that have been taken as hostages by Hamas, their hopes are again elevated and then quickly dashed. The question is, who's to blame here? I think, you know, primarily it's the country that I'm talking to you from, the United States, that holds all the cards. It's the Biden administration that has an incredible amount of leverage over the parties, particularly Israel. It simply refuses to use that leverage to push this, you know, this crisis into a better direction.
Let me continue with you, Nader, on the U.S. front. In an interview this weekend, Joe Biden said Israel is risking losing international support. Some people would see that as a sort of ratcheting up, at least in terms of words, from the U.S. But why can't or won't the U.S. put more pressure on Israel to get more aid in by ground, for instance, to Gaza?
Well, I think the United States views Israel as its, you know, loyal ally, its closest ally in the Middle East. It doesn't want to offend Israeli sensibilities after October the 7th. I think the United States is thinking that it has geostrategic reasons for supporting Israel and not coming down hard and establishing, you know, clear red lines for Israel. So there's the whole set of sort of geopolitical consequences. There's also the fact that Joe Biden himself is probably one of the most pro-Israel presidents in the history of the United States, just based on his, you know, statements since he's been in public office. There's also the fact that the United States is facing an election right now, and there's a lot of discussion about, you know, young people and the Arab American and Muslim community in Michigan that might shape the outcome of this election. But on the other side, you know, Joe Biden is also deeply dependent on financial support from very prominent pro-Israel donors, particularly in different parts of the United States that are, you know, backing the Biden campaign and will not take nicely to the fact that Biden might establish, you know, a tougher line with respect to Israel. So I think that's part of the calculation of the Biden administration itself. So when you put that all together, I think that probably explains why the United States still is supporting Israel almost unconditionally, thus producing this, you know, morally obscene situation in Gaza that we've all been watching for the last 5 months.
Bijan, on Thursday at the State of the Union, Joe Biden talked about, I won't get the quote exactly right, but he said something like, there's never been a better friend than himself to Israel. At the same time, he announced plans for this temporary port in Gaza to bring more aid by sea, and the American military set sail over to Gaza. They think it's going to take about 2 months to get this port, this temporary dock up and running, and people in Gaza need food. They need medical supplies. They're doing airdrops, but it's not enough. How should the world be looking at getting aid into Gaza right now?
You know, the best way really is the land corridors to get those trucks that are waiting at the border to get them going and let them in Gaza so that they can deliver the humanitarian aid that has been waiting at the border for a long time, and to ensure that these inspections by the Israeli forces happen quickly enough so that aid can be processed efficiently and get to the people who deserve it, the people of Gaza who are in this humanitarian crisis at this point. You know, the airdrops, they're not efficient at all. Just a couple of days ago, five Palestinians in Gaza were killed as a result of these airdrops. The port is going to take about up to 2 months, you know, people need aid right now. So the best way is for Israel to let the land corridors to open for the air to be delivered.
Short of that, which doesn't seem to be happening, there is this aid that is in Cyprus waiting to be sailed over to Israel, but Israel says it has to inspect it first. So we'll see if people get what they need inside Gaza. I also want to ask you, Nader, about, you know, you talked about American politics, but I want to talk to you about kind of that relationship with Israel a little bit more. We saw Benny Gantz, this prominent member of Israel's government, going to the United States last week, meeting with Vice President Kamala Harris, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Gantz is in the war cabinet, but he's seen as more moderate, also seen as someone who could replace Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And as you looked at Gantz coming over to the United States, did you see this in any way being the U.S. sort of sending a soft message to Netanyahu that it is time to go and that they're feeling out Gantz?
That's possible. I think a lot of that is, in my reading, public relations. The United States is trying to sort of, you know, suggest that it's unhappy with the policies of the Netanyahu government. But that's all rhetoric. What really is required is, you know, a serious policy change to incentivize Netanyahu to, you know, change his policy in Gaza. So I don't put a lot of stock in these types of, you know, meetings suggesting that somehow Benny Gantz's visit to Washington, D.C. suggests some sort of inevitable policy change or a changing, you know, attitude in the Biden administration that's going to finally, you know, read Israel the Riot Act for committing a plausible genocide in Gaza. I don't see that coming. I think the Biden administration would like the Netanyahu government to coordinate its policy more closely with the United States and allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza. But I don't see the United States doing what is, you know, is needed at this moment and establishing clear consequences for Israel, specifically with respect to, you know, the provision of arms to Israel, which is, you know, responsible for, killing roughly 30,000 people over the last 5 months. That's what needs to happen. And I don't see that happening anytime soon from this administration in Washington, D.C.
So as that sort of political side happens, the issue of aid continues to be politicized in many ways. And Bijan, on Friday, Canada confirmed that it is going to resume funding to the United Nations Relief Agency for Palestinians. This is known as UNRWA. We were one of 16 countries that paused funding after allegations surfaced that a dozen of its contractors were involved in the October 7th attack. So now Canada, along with Sweden, have announced they're resuming funding. Israel is calling this decision by Canada a, quote, serious mistake. So this is a divisive issue. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has called UNRWA a terrorist organization. Is this, Bijan, the right move by Canada?
You know, I think the situation that Canada and other donors to UNRWA faces that was that the allegations against UNRWA, specific employees of UNRWA being involved in October 7th attack, those are serious allegations. However, the United Nations and UNRWA have started internal investigations and also independent investigations as well. And there have been already some discussion about these investigations and their interim reports. The United Nations also claiming that the Israeli government has not provided them with the evidence to corroborate some of these allegations. At the same time, Canada and other donors facing the situation that there is no replacement for UNRWA in the short term for delivering humanitarian aid in Gaza. They are the only organization that have the infrastructure, have the capacity to deliver aid efficiently to people of Gaza, to distribute the aid that will be delivered, whether through land, whether through port, etc. So the issue is, if they want to support and ensure that aid will be delivered, UNRWA is the platform, UNRWA is the organization that right now they can support to provide that aid to the people of Gaza. So I think that is the main reason. This organization cannot be replaced in short term, and they have already done, they have already started the process of the investigations into these serious allegations from Israel. So because of these things, I think the Canadian government, Sweden, and some of the other donors have decided to resume funding to UNRWA. Mm.
And Bob Ray, our ambassador to the United Nations, says the Canadian decision was based on the interim report that has come out of the UN's investigation, still waiting for a more robust report. But as he said, waiting for Israel to put its response to it as well. Nader, back in January, the U.S. Secretary of State called Israel's accusations against UNRWA highly credible. I know we're waiting for a number of results, but reports. But what is your assessment on the resumption of funding, at least by Canada and Sweden at this point?
Well, obviously, it's the right decision. But I think we have to go back to, you know, January 26th, when Canada announced it was cutting off aid to UNRWA at the request of Israel. Let's just remember, you know, what was happening at that time. You know, Canada likes to claim it's an honest broker. It's a member in good standing of the international community. But it cuts off aid to a UN relief agency in the midst of mass starvation and in the context of a plausible genocide, when the day before the World Court ordered Israel to resume and to come to the support of suffering Palestinians who are facing, you know, a major humanitarian crisis. Canada does the exact opposite. So I think what's happening here, and Canada's response to, you know, this situation with UNRWA is really a moral stain on Canada's reputation, and it goes beyond simply reputational damage, and it has moved in the direction of what I think is perilous legal liability. Canada now has to, I think, you know, brace itself for an international legal case where Canada will be charged, and I would argue rightfully, for complicity in mass starvation as a weapon of war and knowingly creating conditions for the spread of infectious diseases you know, that can lead to mass death and suffering. That's what Canada has done. And so I think looking back on this particular moment in Canadian foreign policy, I think future historians are going to write about this episode as perhaps some of the darkest days in Canada's foreign relations, when these types of things were done by the government of Canada against the backdrop of immense suffering.
There are those that would say the allegations against at least 12 UNRWA contractors at that time, though not are, were serious enough that we had to put a pause on funding.
Yeah, I disagree. I mean, just think about it. Let's say there's a, you know, a hospital, you know, dealing with the needs of a particular community, and a handful of people who work in that hospital are alleged to have done something, you know, deeply criminal and unethical. Do you shut down the entire hospital because of allegations against a handful of people working in that hospital? Does that make any sense? Now, on top of the fact, let's not forget that these allegations are being made by a country that has been plausibly condemned for possible genocide in front of the world court. That seems not to be a factor in Canada's decision. Any way you look at it, this is a deep moral stain that Canada cannot easily erase. The allegations made by Israel don't stand up to critical scrutiny. And so I think, you know, any way you look at this, what Canada has done, I think merits, if there's any sort of, I think, serious attempt to learn lessons from this moment, it merits a parliamentary inquiry. Who made these decisions? Why did they make these decisions, given what's happening in Gaza, given what Israel has been doing? I think we need more of a public discussion and accountability for this particular type of behavior.
Bijan, the last time you were on this program, you said that as a middle country, Canada has limitations when it comes to its influence over what happens. Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly is about to be on a trip or is on a trip to the Middle East right now, visiting a number of spots, including Israel, Jerusalem, the occupied West Bank. Just before I let both of you go, and Bijan, let me begin with you. You know, we're now into month six of this war, and at the beginning of our conversation, Nader outlined the statistics, which are real people on both sides who have been deeply impacted by this conflict. So what is your message to the heads of state in each of our countries, the U.S. and Canada, as this war drags on? Bijan.
I said that in the last interview that Canada's interest in the Middle East is limited, and also our role and our influence is limited as well. And one of the reasons I've been repeating this in different interviews is that I hope our people, Canadians overall, also understand this because of some of the scenes that we're seeing in the streets of Toronto and other cities across Canada, with people standing across the streets and showing acts or saying things that are anti-Semitic or Islamophobic from both sides of people who support one side or the other of this conflict. I hope that our leaders also deliver this message, because I think that the hate, the division that we are witnessing on our streets are dangerous, and our leaders need to talk to our people, to Canadians, to inform them about our limited interests in the Middle East and about the limitation that we have in terms of what we can do to make significant change on the ground with respect to this conflict. Mm. The most important thing that I think we should do is to ensure that aid gets into Gaza and work and coordinate with our allies and partners, which is what the Canadian government is really doing right now, to facilitate aid getting into Gaza and to pressure the Israeli government to ensure that they let aid get into Gaza, especially through the land corridors.
Nader, what should Western governments, including Canada and U.S., what's your message to them now?
Well, you know, Canada, the United States, likes to talk about a rules-based international order, the sanctity of international law. These high principles are routinely invoked when it comes to the crisis in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe. But when it comes to the Middle East and when it comes to Israel-Palestine in particular, those same types of values and norms are quickly jettisoned and abandoned. And so it's very hard to take Canada seriously when it applies such grotesque double standards on the international stage. I think a rules-based order matters. I think, you know, fighting against war crimes and crimes against humanity and supporting institutions like the International Court of Justice matter if you care about a better world. But when Canada sort of applies clear double standards, it undermines, I think, world order. It also undermines Canada's reputation, which, you know, I think has sunk to very low levels based on what Canada has done over the last 5 months in the context of Israel and Gaza.
We will leave it there. Thank you both, Bijan and Nader, for your analysis and your views today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bia.
Bijan Ahmadi is the executive director at the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy. It's based in Toronto. And Nader Hashemi is an associate professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. It is spring or winter break season for many across the country. And for some people, that means packing up and jetting off to somewhere warm and sunny. And if you want to travel down memory lane while relaxing, think back 4 years ago tomorrow when travel around the world came to a crashing halt with the declaration of the COVID pandemic. The UN's World Tourism Organization predicts that this year, international tourism will reach pre-pandemic levels, even warning that 2024 could be the worst year ever for over-tourism. Bruce Poon-Tip has dedicated his career to thinking about the impact and power of travel. Bruce is the founder of G Adventures, a Canadian small group adventure travel company, and the world's largest at that. His initiatives in community-driven sustainable tourism were recognized with an appointment to the Order of Canada last summer. Bruce Poon-Tip, hi.
Hello.
Where on this planet have I found you today?
I am in Barbados today, but I'm actually off to Australia tomorrow.
And what's going on in Barbados? What do you like about Barbados?
Well, it's kind of nice. It's kind of warm. It's kind of avoiding winter. It's kind of a place in the middle that's nice and warm and easygoing and just can relax.
Bruce, I love to travel. Like anyone in the same boat, we all have our own reasons for venturing out, you know, a couple times a year, some people more, some people less if we can afford it. Mm-hmm. But you have made this your life's work. So after more than three decades in this business, what is it about traveling that you hold so deep and dear to you?
I mean, I think there's different times in my life where travel has meant different things. And you need and want different things as you get older or you get married or you have children. There's all kinds of things, life things that, but travel in general is just, I think, one of the most valuable things for me, it's about cultural immersion, learning other cultures, understanding your place in the universe is how I often say it. Because when you come back from travel, you have a greater appreciation for where you're from, place you're most comfortable with. And when you step out of that comfort zone and travel to other places, it brings you back home better. And so the beautiful side of how travel can be transformational for everyone is a big part of why I love it.
The pandemic ground it all to a halt, at least for some period of time. At that time, Bruce, it gave so many people a chance to hopefully stop and think about how we can do this all better as travelers, as vacationers. So how have these past few years changed how you see it? What kinds of reflections have you been having?
You know, there was all this talk about how we can come back better because we're all forced into this hibernation. You know, we all had to lay off, you know, massive amounts of employees and we could just build back better as an industry. Because I don't think prior to the pandemic, travel was really in a good place. And I used to talk about that quite a bit. There's a small amount of people that are traveling different after the pandemic. And it's enough to change the landscape of the travel industry in terms of what people want. People be more connected to the destination and the purpose on why they want to travel. And that's really what I want to see in travel, where people are where travel is more meaningful to people. And people, because we're at a place now with mainstream travel where they're selling amenities and distractions over the destination, and people are connected to where they're going because they're just connected to amenities and the comforts of home. And I think that's a dangerous place to be in travel. So
what do you mean by amenities versus the destination?
Well, you look at how travel sold before the pandemic and even now, like, I mean, it's all about, you know, 10 different restaurants. So when you're in another country, you can eat sushi and Italian food and French food on different days. You know, Broadway shows, indoor zip lining, indoor surfing, thread counts on sheets. These amenities become more important than the destination to the customer. And tour operators are, you know, trying to give people all the comforts of home. And, you know, we've always suggested if you want the comforts of home, maybe you should consider staying at home. Hmm. And people are buying amenities and are no longer connected to the destination on which they're going.
You're sort of advocating for, look, part of the joy of going somewhere else is to disrupt your normalcy and what you are used to. What's good about disruption, do you think, for humans?
Well, stepping out of your comfort zone gives you a greater appreciation for where you come from. That's the first thing. Travel can be transformational, not just for you, that one-way conversation of a tourist that just kind of pays for, you know, a certain level of services and wants to be served when they're on vacation. You know, your decision to go on holiday can be transformational for local communities if done right. It, you know, travel is a $10 trillion industry. It's one in every 10 jobs in the world is in tourism. You know, it has the ability to be the greatest form of wealth distribution that the world's ever seen if it's done right. You know, we're traveling to some of the 40 poorest countries, the most in-need citizens in the world. We're taking vacations there. But if the business model is just sucking that money out of the economy and local people aren't benefiting, we're missing a great opportunity to transform lives by the idea of you saying you just want to go on holiday. And so that's really the power of what travel can be. But unfortunately, we missed that mark by creating these, you know, compound resorts or cruises or and really focusing on making sure people feel like they never left home. They have all the comforts. You know, when thread counts on sheets become, you know, a main part of why you're, you know, your sales process, I think there's something wrong. And it's suddenly become a thing.
You've been critical at times. You're being critical now, and that's fine, of the kind of tourism that sometimes involves, you know, cruises or those all-inclusive resorts, describing it as a one-way conversation. That is all, as you've just suggested, that's all about pleasing the customer. Now, first of all, full transparency, I've been on a cruise. I've been to all-inclusives before. Mm-hmm. I will go to all-inclusives again. I've thrown on backpacks. I continue to do that. I take suitcases. I do all kinds of traveling.
Yeah.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, Bruce, and guess that a lot of listeners might not see a problem with, you know, they work hard. They've saved up some money. They want to go sit at an all-inclusive resort all week and eat fancy foods and drink nice cocktails. What's wrong with that? Like, what would you say to that?
I don't think anything is actually wrong with it. I think there's a place for that and for people who, you're right, you work hard and you just want to shut off and you want everything done for you in a resort. I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, I can make environmental arguments about, you know, these mass compounds that have, you know, 10,000 people in them consuming mass amounts of natural resources when people on the other side of that wall don't have access to clean drinking water or medical care. That could be an argument that you can make for it, but actually, there's a market for it. I think that the business models have to change, though, that the communities benefit from you being there. That's the significant thing that bothers me. It's not the actual experience of being in a resort and having beautiful food and, you know, not having to do anything and having, you know, that service. But the business models of those resorts and those cruise ships are to drive money right back and out of the country. And so my issue with it really is local people benefiting from you being there. And there's ways you can do it. I mean, you know, the leakage of money leaving the country, it's totally fixable. It's just how bad do we want to fix the model? But that's my issue with it. I mean, I actually don't have a problem with the experience. And I can tell you, my parents were in their 80s. They were, you know, they had fewer years to travel. And the best way to send them away was, you know, to take, they went to see Asia before, you know, before they got too old to travel. And I put them on a ship, one of those trips that, you know, visited 10 countries in 10 days. And it was a great experience for them.
So if you want people, as you do, to have a more holistic look, no matter what kind of traveling they're doing, what do you want people to consider if they are booking that kind of, you know, cruise that your parents took or that resort type of trip?
Well, there's just companies that do it better. And you just have to ask the questions. Cruising by nature is never going to be sustainable. But there's companies that do it better, and that's all you really can do. And that's all you can really ask. I mean, if you look at the broader picture of tourism, getting there by plane and fossil fuels and, you know, jet fuel and all that stuff, that's an issue. Travel is never zero impact, but it's about asking questions, making better choices, and actually just caring. If you start actually caring, if more people started caring where they spent their money, operators and hoteliers and transportation companies would change to fill the demand of people asking those questions.
I think you said the tourism industry is, what did you say it was, 10 trillion?
10 trillion, yeah.
Yeah, so $10 trillion is what gets into the coffers of the tourism industry. What do we know? What do we actually know about how much or how many of our tourism dollars actually make their way into those local communities? So I go to point A, I've asked my, you know, hotel or whatever, all the right questions, but do we know what kind of money is actually staying in the communities we go to visit?
We do. Because it's studied by the United Nations Environment Program. So UNEP studies that regularly. And it's $7 every $100 spent stays in the local economy. And that's up, by the way, because a decade ago it was five.
And the rest goes where, Bruce?
It goes back to public companies that are driving growth for shareholders.
So, Bruce, I want to take kind of a giant step back to better understand how we've arrived at this place that we are in the first place. Before the pandemic, international travel was on more or less of a straight incline, right? Peaked in 2019. We saw you could get a cheap flight almost anywhere. There was the rise of hotel search engines, blogs, you know, people staying in Airbnbs and all of that. What sort of led up to that? Like, did we see this huge shift in humans becoming, or at least humans with money, becoming more interested in going to other places in the world?
No, it has to do with the actual more lift. When there's more lift or more planes flying, it becomes cheaper. Fuel went down to $17 a barrel. And you might not know what that means to, you know, many industries, the impact of the cost of fuel, price per barrel, but it really benefits airlines. When fuel goes down in price, you'll see all of a sudden in the last 5 years when the price per barrel of fuel went down, there was suddenly a huge rise almost immediately in discount airlines. Suddenly every major airline formed their own discount airlines to compete with the discount airlines. And so suddenly there's more planes in the air, there's more capacity, and flight prices are driven down. So it becomes cheaper, easier, faster over time to get to travel. And now fuel is going up to $60 a barrel at the moment, which is really where it should be. That's because if you can remember a decade ago, it went up to 120 and the airlines were crying, asking for bailouts and we can't survive and all kinds of things were going on. All these airlines were back up. It's a boom bust market tied to fuel. So when we're at a decent level for the price of fuel, which is the main operating cost of the air industry, and then more airlines come in, more discount airlines pop up everywhere. And then planes are getting more fuel efficient. Planes are getting faster. When that happens and prices go down, more people start to travel.
I'm glad you brought up discount airlines and when they boom, because right now, a lot of them are shutting down. We saw, you know, Lynx Air, Canadian airline, recently announced it shutting down. Swoop, CanJet, yeah. Zoom. There's more.
They can't survive on $60. North of $60 a barrel oil, they can't maintain their prices, the prices that drive people to book on those discount airlines.
But what's been the broader impact of cheap travel, do you think, in your view?
Personally, I think it's a positive that more people can travel. We have the opportunity for more people to travel. I think I have a very esoteric view of travel and that, you know, the travel can be, you know, the greatest path to peace for the planet. If more people knew how other people lived in other countries, maybe there wouldn't be the type of disruption, violence and disruption and, you know, divisiveness that's going on today in politics, which kind of bleeds into our real life. And I think if more people traveled, I mean, there would be a lot less, you know, there'd be more tolerance and less ignorance. But with more and more people traveling, it creates this tipping point with these companies that are promising infinite growth in the travel industry through public companies and shareholder value. But we've got a finite amount of places we can visit in the world. So these two business models are on a collision course. It's not sustainable to continue to promise infinite growth, but only have a certain amount of places that we can go.
Hmm. We know that a lot of families will be getting on planes in these coming weeks as their winter and spring breaks throughout our country. Some people are going to wait, Bruce, to try and get that last minute deal. I'm not going to ask you about the last minute deals per se, other than to ask you, like, is how do you look at those last minute deals in that sort of, like, as you say, esoteric, more philosophical way, and in a practical way too? Like, what are they doing to our travel industry?
The idea of last minute is a whole concept that started in the early 90s in the UK with the last minute club. Things got cheaper as you booked closer to departure. If you remember back then, you actually got cheaper when you booked further out. That was the concept. So last minute club changed the consumer buying patterns by making things cheaper by last minute. Now, those experiences and that type of travel is a commodity. Now, I think there's a big difference between a traveler and a tourist, right? And a tourist is someone who is looking to go to another country and they're looking to book capacity. They're not looking for an experiential, life-changing, transformational experience when they travel. As an industry, we end up pushing capacity because there's more and more capacity coming. There's always a bigger ship. There's always bigger resorts. There's always more capacity because we're delivering on this model of infinite growth. So it's important for people. And I totally agree with people that, you know, want to get out to travel and just want to lie on a beach for a week and have, you know, eat and drink, you know, all inclusive. And I understand that model. But when I get a chance to talk about it, I just want people to know there's other options. There's just better ways you can choose to travel. And you can have an impact and And then there's better ways you can do any type of travel. You just have to be more conscious and understanding the power you have when you decide to go on holiday. And with that privilege, I think comes a much greater responsibility than people understand.
Hmm. And then there are environmentalists, some of whom say, look, just stop all this. The age of compromise should and must end, that we have crossed a red line when it comes to our climate crisis. There is no amount of carbon offsets or sustainable alternatives that are going to solve things, that we need to essentially slow down altogether, suggesting that some people need to stop flying altogether. How do you respond to that, Bruce?
So I do think it's an issue. And so I don't try and knock the issue about the climate crisis or carbon emissions. I think the solution for this lies in better ways in which we can, you know, we have to solve it as a planet because our economy requires air travel. So there's all kinds of things. Carbon capture is something that, you know, I follow very closely, which where, you know, exists, you know, whether it's electric planes, it's, you know, some form of biofuel or we should be solving that. And is my answer to that. I do think it's a massive problem in terms of, you know, this whole concept of carbon offsetting, whether you believe in it or not, it's certainly not a science, but there's just better ways we can do things. And I don't think the answer is traveling less. That, of course, I'm going to make that argument, of course, because I'm in the travel industry, but I'll also say that, and if done right, travel can be also transformational for some of the poorest citizens on the planet. If by you going on vacation, you spend money in their economy and create that wealth distribution, there's another reason why travel can be a force for good. With anything in the world that you pick to criticize for about the planet or the climate, there's some things you can just do better. I think people staying home is not going to impact the flight lift around the world.
I'm guilty as a traveler of all the things that people point out. You know, if you want to, I've gotten on planes too much and all those things. So I understand the criticism as well. Mm-hmm. One of them, I've been to Machu Picchu. If we use that as an example, your company goes to Machu Picchu. It's mm-hmm. a site that's seen irreversible damage in some areas as a result of over tourism. And I know it's mm-hmm. an argument you also hear, and people I hold dear to me will say, why would you have gone and done that? And I accept to have that debate. Do you see yourself as having a certain amount of, I don't know, responsibility as a travel company for the harms that are caused by mass travel?
Yes and no. I mean, we do things in very small groups, and we're on the extreme end of responsible, sustainable community tourism, like all of those. So, I mean, we do a lot of work. I mean, we have a whole foundation, the Planetaire Foundation, that actually regulates what we do, but also creates community development where we do tours. So yes, I mean, we do look at it. We do, you know, do what we can to, you know, to lessen our impact, work with communities and make sure communities benefit. We create technology that gauges, you know, how we buy product, create product is in constant dialogue with communities. And so local communities benefit. And so that's our model, but we're on the extreme end of being responsible when traveling. But yeah, I mean, the idea about over-tourism is a really, really interesting one because, you know, how it's written or how it's talked about is what you say, Machu Picchu or Venice. It seems to be a real flashpoint for everyone about, you know, thousands of people. But I mean, the argument with that is, you know, Venice is not a tourism destination anymore. It's a theme park. And so is Machu Picchu. You buy tickets. Machu Picchu now, when you buy your ticket, you can't even go when you want. You have a two-hour window in which you can travel. It's as heavily regulated and run differently than destinational management. And you now have to buy a ticket to enter Venice. It's a theme park. So its challenges are very different. I think it's dangerous when we talk about over-tourism and we compare it, because the bigger problem is that we as tourists are traveling into more remote areas. We're traveling into local, small communities. People want to see indigenous communities. People want to go into the Amazon and see rainforest tribes. And, you know, 50 people to that community is considered over-tourism. And so over-tourism is just is a flashpoint buzzword using Machu Picchu and Venice as an example. But really, the issue of over-tourism is a much bigger issue. When the new cruise ship that was just launched a couple of weeks ago, 7,000 people, goes to an island like Anguilla with 9,000 people. And the people can, you know, spend over $100,000 on that island in 6 hours visiting. Suddenly, and then that ship comes every Tuesday and Thursday. Suddenly kids aren't going to school. because they're trying to get a piece of vulnerable communities are vulnerable to, you know, commercial activity. So suddenly the long-term, you know, cultural heritage preservation, the idea of cultural heritage preservation and cultural heritage impact is huge when you look at that as a form of over-tourism. And so we should have different rules of how we look at that. We should look at it very differently when we talk about over-tourism, because it's a much broader problem than just, you know, hundreds of thousands of people wanting to see Machu Picchu.
These are complex issues that are related to tourism. At the end of the day, though, I think some people are just like, I just want to go on my flight. I want to go there. And they're doing that. And, escapism and wonder and wander are beautiful things for us humans. We live in a difficult, difficult time. Before I let you go, Bruce, I just want you to tell us what sort of your personal travel ethos that you want to leave people with thinking about as they plan their next trip or they're about to embark and get on a plane in the coming months?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it's a very easy one to answer. The people have to understand that travel is a privilege. You have no right to travel. There's very few people on the planet that get the opportunity to say, I want to go on vacation. And so with that ability to go on vacation, and you work hard, so you have every ability to say you want to go on vacation, take a vacation. With that privilege, it has great responsibility. And people have to just change their mindset. The travel is a privilege in the Western developed world. It's not a right. And you don't have a right to anything. And you can't suspend your values the way you live at home, because we all live with our values at home, where we recycle and we have low watt light bulbs and we, you know, live in a 100-mile diets and organic. And then you suspend those beliefs and your values when you go to another country. So I think more and more people have to understand the privilege they have when they get to travel. You know, and it's a two-way conversation where everyone should benefit.
Bruce, thank you very much. I so appreciate your perspective. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bruce Poon-Tip is the founder of G Adventures. Now, we want to get your take on the complicated questions around travel these days. Have you changed how you approach travel over the past few years? Do climate change or cultural tensions shape your choices? What other factors go into your decision to take a trip? Or maybe to stay at home. Tell us about your travel philosophy. Send us an email, sunday@cbc.ca.
The climate is changing, so are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
If you are a movie buff, tonight could be one of the longest nights you spend in front of a screen all year, because the Oscars broadcast includes a whopping 23 different award categories. And there's one group of people who think there should be yet another category. In fact, they believe they are being unfairly shut out of Hollywood's biggest night. One man in particular has spent decades trying to right what he says is a wrong. Here's Joan Weber from CBC's audio doc unit with our Sunday documentary. This is called Missing in Action.
To understand a bit about the psyche of the man who spent more than 30 years campaigning to get a stunt category at the Oscars, I need to tell you this story. In 1979, Jack Gill's dad pleaded with him not to take a stunt job on a Hollywood movie called The Exterminator.
Not The Terminator, but The Exterminator.
That's Jack.
And my father said, you know, I'll pay you to not do it.
Jack and I are on a video call. He's got some photos on the wall behind him, cars flying through the air, and a raft of clapperboards. Those are the things that snap together when the director yells action. I can see one that says Jumanji, and another for Fast and Furious 8. But way back, when Jack gets approached to do this movie, The Exterminator, he's just 23 years old. And he's told five stunt performers have already turned the job down. You see, the director has a vision for the opening, even before the credits roll.
He wants a black screen and he wants to see his lead character running across the top of a cliff, a mountaintop, at night, and this airplane comes up behind him and drops napalm and blows the entire cliff up, and this guy sails off the top of the cliff and drops in to hit on a downhill, and he's barely alive.
Before agreeing to this, Jack wants to eyeball the location. So he's taken to the edge of this cliff in Valencia, California. And the first thing he notices is that it's not a sheer drop, it's sloped, which makes placing an airbag below tricky. He's told the closest they can get it is about 20 feet or roughly 6 meters out. What that means is to make that jump from that height, Jack's really got to fly outward a long way before he comes down. So he asks for an air ram. That's a stunt tool which looks a little like a ramp, but when you run onto it, it triggers a switch which catapults you up and forward like a human projectile.
And it throws you high and far away, and we use them for explosions.
And for this particular napalm explosion, Jack has questions about what that might look like.
And they said, it's 13 gallons of gasoline they're going to layer on the top, and another 8 gallons in the side of the cliff on the way down that's going to shoot out. But we're going to try and direct that away from you, but they want to see you flying through the air with a big fireball behind you and then another fireball that comes out from the side of the cliff.
Jack points out that they didn't have protective fire gel back then, just flame-resistant clothing.
Which doesn't help your face or hands or anything else. So all I could do was wet myself down.
So the day arrives and Jack's going to do the stunt.
So I get out to the cliff and it's nighttime.
And he rehearses several times on flat ground. First time works great, second perfect.
And then the third time I tried it, it misfired. And I went to the effects guy and I said, if this thing misfires, does the gasoline still go off? And he goes, yeah, it's keyed into the air ram. The gasoline's still going to fire. And if it misfires, you'll still be on top of the cliff when 13 gallons of gasoline goes off.
This was a line too far. So Jack says, nope, sorry, not going to do it with faulty equipment. So next thing you know, the stunt coordinator, the guy responsible for this scene, is racing home to fetch a new air ram.
And now it's like 4 a.m. And so I get ready to go with your old camera. We've got 9 cameras all rolling. And then I hear cut, cut, cut. Hey, the paramedic down here wants to know what blood type the stunt guy is in case he gets burned. And I went, you know what, guys, just roll camera. Let's just roll camera and get this over with. And I ran, hit the thing, it fired me up in the air. And when I was up in the air, I felt like the concussion of the 13 gallons of gasoline, I felt like somebody had hit me in the back with the flat end of a shovel, just square in the back, because I felt like it pushed me out a little more. And as I was turning over, I saw everybody running the other direction, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to miss the airbag.
When you watch the opening of the film, you can see how Jack manages the force by which he's thrown out in front of this ginormous orange glowing fireball. It almost looks like he's doing the front crawl through an invisible current. Jack hits the airbag perfectly. Apparently, everyone had been running to dodge the fire that was raining down on them.
The director came over and shook my hand, and everybody was cheering and clapping. And I got a whopping $750 for that. So at the time, $750 was a lot to me. And, I kind of made my name in the business from that one stunt. You know, it was something that is an accomplishment that I will always look back on, but never do again.
So the upshot of this story is, don't tell Jack Gill he can't do something. It might explain why, after more than 3 decades of unsuccessfully lobbying for a stunt category at the Oscars, Jack refuses to give up.
Says, "Dear Don, I am writing to formally request that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences discuss and vote to create a branch and add a category for best stunt coordinator / action designer."
For years, Jack has been sending a version of this letter to the Academy.
Stunt coordinators are an integral and active component of the film industry and have long deserved an Oscar category.
When he started out, he figured it could be a long process, maybe 3-5 years.
Well, I mean, I've gotten so many reasons why over the 32 years that I've been doing this that they've stop giving reasons anymore because they just can't think up anything else.
Jack's a veteran stunt coordinator now, designing action scenes for movies like Universal Pictures' Fast and Furious franchise. In number 8, he choreographed a breathtakingly high-speed drag race through the narrow streets of Havana. And he configured a way to make the lead actor look as though he's racing backwards after his car bursts into flames.
To do that, I created a vehicle with a steering on the other side of the car. And then I put another steering cubicle on top of the car, and I put another stunt person, Alan Padelford, who was the stunt person. He drove that car from the roof of the car while it was going backwards.
Like most coordinators, Jack spent years performing stunts. Just before the Exterminator role, he landed steady work as the stunt double for his pal John Schneider
on Warner Brothers' The Dukes of Hazzard,
piloting the show's orange Dodge Charger. Jack would do these novel jumps that would become known for how high and far the car would soar.
Dukes of Hazzard kind of started the big car jumps. And so instead of the car being 4 or 5 feet off the ground, the car was now 20 feet off the ground, traveling hundreds of feet. And, you know, when you're dropping a 4,000-pound car out of the sky from 20 feet, your body takes a big toll.
People would sit on inner tubes to cushion the landings, he says. But even so, people were breaking their backs in those days. This was before safety harnesses were invented. Jack got noticed on Dukes and later on Knight Rider. And pretty soon, he was being asked to do motorcycle jumps, falls, crashes for movies like Cannonball Run and Megaforce. And as time wore on, he came to believe it was unfair that movies, which the stunt industry had been heavily involved in, were winning Oscars on ABC's live broadcast for seemingly everything but stunts.
Here are the nominees for Achievement in Cinematography.
Here are the nominees for Achievement in Visual Effects.
Here are the nominees for Achievement in Makeup and Hairstyle.
Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Ruth Carter.
To not even be in the show is the tough part about it. That's the really hard part about doing these films. Sometimes we're on these films for 8 months, and then to see all your other peers go up on the stage and accept, and you're sitting at home watching it on the TV.
So Jack started a petition. He got people like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg to sign it. Today, he's got nearly 133,000 signatures.
You know, I'd like to say to the Academy that if you took the Chariot Race out of Ben-Hur, would it have been the same movie? And it wouldn't have been, because in every single teaser that you see for Ben-Hur, that Chariot Race is in there.
But none of his arguments, nor his petition, seem to have helped. Despite this, Jack figures the stunt industry is closer today than ever to attaining its goal. It's striking that in 2020, during ABC's Oscar broadcast, a stuntman did manage to score a golden statue.
Here are the nominees for performance.
Only catch? He won for playing a stuntman, not for being one.
Brad Pitt.
This was for his role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But with the world watching, Brad took the opportunity to give a plug for the industry's real stunt performers.
You know, I also want to say, you know, while we're doing all this, I think it's time we give a little love to our stunt coordinators and our stunt crews.
Listen. It was great for Brad to say that, because it's one of the things that we say, isn't it amazing that an actor who plays a stuntman can win an Oscar, but yet being a stuntman, you can't win an Oscar.
It's not a good feeling when you know how much work stunt people put into it and how much money those movies make.
This is Monique Ganderton. She's a Canadian who made headlines in 2018 for being Marvel Studios' first female stunt coordinator for the movie Avengers: Infinity War.
You have a chair next to the director. They're constantly looking to you for advice. And you're just such a part of the nucleus of making these movies these days.
Monique now lives on a ranch just outside Atlanta. And so we meet up on a video call.
I'm a tough, very tough person, because just by default, because I grew up in freaking Edmonton. And,
it's stuff like her dad making her take her driver's test in a prairie blizzard that she credits for preparing her for a career she fell into by accident. She was doing some modeling in Toronto when her agency got her a job as an extra on the TV show La Femme Nikita. There she was starstruck, not by the lead, but by the stunt double.
And she rolled down some stairs and she did this little fight and like shot some people. And then she was like pulling up her
or taking her pads off. And I was like, who is this amazing person? Like,
holy crap. As Monique's talking, I can see why she stunt doubled for Charlize Theron in Universal Pictures action flick Atomic Blonde. She manages to look ferocious in this fight scene, which was filmed inside the stairwell of an old Hungarian apartment in Budapest. The character battles a whole string of bad guys. Monique's particularly proud of this sequence, in part because she helped choreograph it. It's succinctly described online as badass. Monique won several awards for this movie, not from the Academy, of course, but from the industry's own celebration called the Taurus Awards. Like Jack, Monique has opinions on why the Academy doesn't hand out Oscars for Best Action.
I have theories. So let's say maybe, 40 years ago, stunt performers and coordinators barely had a credit in the end credits. You know, stunts has just historically been like a secret.
A secret, because the movie business runs on star power. So what happens when you hand out an Oscar to a stunt double for all the cool stuff that someone like a Matt Damon has been believed to have done? Does that take away a little bit of the Hollywood magic? Jack says this was one of the first reasons he was given by the Academy.
It started out with, well, we don't want the actors to let the public know that they have stunt doubles. And I said, this is not for stunt doubles. It's for the actual stunt coordinator.
His pitch was for the designers of the action to be acknowledged, the way department heads are recognized in other categories, such as special effects and editing. That way, the recipients...
They're not talking about stunt doubles. They're just talking about a sequence that they designed. So we got past that. And then they said, well, if we have an action category, we're going to have to delete one of our categories to get the time frame in. And I said, well, why don't we cut down one of the dance numbers or one of the comic numbers for a minute, and you could get it in there. And they said, no, we can't do that. So I said, okay, great. Next year, we said, let's say we're not in the big show. Let's say we're in the scientific awards, and 2 days before you give us an award, it's not televised, it's in the scientific award. And we got shot down there. So then we said, how about we're not in the scientific awards? How about it's just an award given in a, you know, it could be a hallway somewhere.
The notion that stunt performers are perpetually kept in the shadows goes way back.
Well, I'm not the kind to kiss and tell, but I've been seen with Farrah.
You might remember this theme song from the old ABC series, The Fall Guy. It describes the woes of the stuntman, who never gets any respect. The stars get all the credit, and the double is the doofus who gets all the injuries. Lee Majors played the lead. The lyrics really sum it up.
I might fall from a tall building, I might roll a brand new car, 'cause I'm the unknown stuntman, and they Redford such a star.
For a long time, for Monique's family and friends, she was kind of the unknown stunt person. She says her mother
didn't know what I really did for a living.
But that changed when her mom got a job on the same film set as Monique in Vancouver, in the props department.
And she'd never been on a film set before. And I actually had to be like, Mom, you have to bring me my grenade launcher. And they were putting up this big, like, Lexan barrier for the crew, right? So they're putting up these big walls and everyone's like, we got to go around the block, get back. We're going to blow all this stuff up. And so I'm in front of this barrier, obviously, because I'm on camera. And she's bringing me my grenade launcher as everyone is getting like pushed like a block away. And she looks at me and she's like, oh, my God, this is what you do? And I'm like, yeah, thanks for the grenade launcher, Mom. I'll see you in a bit. And I was like, they blew up like four cars. I swear, I probably couldn't hear, but I swear I heard my mom like screaming, like squealing and from a block away.
So what I'm going to do is if I'm leading, I'm just going to try and shake him off of me, essentially.
In a sparse-looking martial arts studio in Vancouver, Kirk Kayouet teaches fight choreography. Pairs move back and forth in what looks like a kind of aggressive animalistic ritual, or possibly a violent tango. This is how Kirk describes it.
Well, fight choreography, good fight
choreography is simply a dance. It's like an expression of violence. Like on the scale between ballroom and martial arts, it's 80% ballroom, right? It's funny, Bruce Lee is known as a martial artist, but his background was in the cha-cha. He was a Hong Kong cha-cha champion.
So part dance, part martial arts, part gymnastics, but the moves must be precise.
Yeah, you have to be quick on your feet to be a stunt person and think fast. Being a few inches off of your mark when you throw a punch and your partner is expecting you to be right there with it when you're doing high-end, fast, you know, Jackie Chan level choreography. Footwork is extremely, extremely important to it. And that's one of the first principles that we train here.
I'm going to give him a bit of assistance with this foot.
In one maneuver he's demonstrating, Kirk looks as though he's pinned to the ground by a fellow stunt double. But in one fluid move, he uses his foot to push away his partner just as that guy hurls himself into the air in a series of dramatic rotations.
So it's 360, 360, 360.
Kirk has been working here in Hollywood North for decades. If you saw Marvel's X-Men 2, you'll have seen him.
Security breach. Jackie, leave.
He doubled Alan Cumming as the Nightcrawler. His months of training for the film are on display as he backflips and leaps his way through the opening White House scene. For Kirk, the fact that there's no Oscar category is simply a snub. And while nobody gets into this line of work for recognition, he says, it is disturbing when you understand what people have sacrificed.
And we've all been hurt, sure. I mean, I've broken my back twice and my neck once, and I've broken 23 bones and cut a finger off and had to have it sewn back on, and punctured lungs and broken clavicles. And yes, it happens. And the business is getting safer. But I don't think that I've ever run into a stunt person who has been working the business for more than 25 years that has never been hurt. It just, if you're doing stunts, eventually something's going to bite you, and you just hope that it doesn't either debilitate you or kill you. So you leave your family early in the morning looking at their faces, and you can't say anything. You just have to say, I love you and I hope I see you later, and you leave. So it's tougher on your family, I think, than it is on the stunt people.
Jack says computer-generated imagery has been a game changer.
We can put bigger cables on people because they can paint those cables out, whereas before we were having to fly people around the set on piano wire, which was really dangerous.
He tells me safety is another one of the issues the Academy brought up with him in the late 90s.
They said, if we give you an award, what's going to keep action designers from going out there and creating these enormously huge stunt sequences just to get an award and people get hurt? And I said, well, you have to look at special effects as well, because they have that exact same ability and they haven't done that.
I could see someone possibly saying, like, oh, it's going to make people want to do crazier stunts or do, you know, yeah, maybe, because I'm sure every Tom Cruise movie would get nominated. As it should, because they do stuff that is beyond, like, my comprehension. Luckily, he has a very safe, very good stunt coordinator, Wade Eastwood, that you know, keeps that in track. But I don't think it works like that, to make a run for more danger just to get an Academy Award. I think it's more like, you know, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think, should have won a stunt award. Like, that was so creative and interesting and unique. So if it breeds creativity, great. But I don't believe, there's no stunt coordinator that's like, yeah, I'm going to like try to hurt somebody. Like, that's the opposite of our job.
I wanted to talk to the CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Bill Kramer. I was told by his communications department that they were unable to set up an interview for the moment. In an email, though, they said stunt coordinators are, quote, a deeply respected part of our membership, and explained that historically, new awards evolve from the Academy's various branches. There are 18 of them, one for cinematographers, one for writers, one for film editors, to name a few. Oscar categories correspond to the branches. So the thing is, up until last year, stunt coordinators didn't have a branch. But now they've got a production and technology branch. It's one of the reasons Jack is encouraged, but at the same time, he points out that this arm of the academy is not actually dedicated to stunt people. It's more of a mishmash of folks, including script supervisors, choreographers, associate producers, etc., etc. And according to Jack, everybody is vying for their own award. Bottom line, he says, if the Academy wanted to give stunt designers a category, it could do it tomorrow, which of course would be too late for this year's Oscars.
If I was the head of the Academy, I would stand up and I'd be like, we apologize for not recognizing you. We've always recognized you under the radar. Here you go.
I hope the Academy understands that people are putting their lives on the line for the public's enjoyment.
And making sacrifices, Kurt Kaowet says, that the public never hears about.
Head injuries have always been our biggest problem because we're performing these things without helmets, of course. We didn't even used to wear helmets in rehearsals. We didn't even know better. Like, I don't know. We don't wear it on the day, so why would we do it now? So head injuries have plagued us.
He says it's well known in the industry that performers will keep concussions and other injuries quiet for fear of not getting work. And they all, Jack, Monique, and Kirk, know performers who have been killed or permanently injured.
One of my best friends, my best friend at the time of the accident, had a safety wire fail and he fell 33 feet headfirst into a concrete parking lot. It was really a miracle that he lived. It was awful. Yeah, he had so many blood transfusions. There's something there that to think that we risk our lives for this industry, and yet it's more important for them to pretend we don't exist than to acknowledge our existence. That kind of hurts. It does. Yeah.
And when you look at films like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and True Lies and all these films, and that's the thing that really hurts us more than anything, is that these wonderful films have passed us by, and these people may not ever get a chance to do something like that again.
That documentary is produced by Joan Weber from CBC's Audio Doc Unit, and you can read more about the case for stunt coordinators to be recognized at the Oscars at our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. Well, a category film lovers will be closely watching at tonight's Oscars is the category for Best Actress. One nominee could make history as the first Indigenous woman to win that award. Blackfoot actress Lily Gladstone starred alongside Leonardo DiCaprio in Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. The film portrays the true story of the dozens of members of the Osage Nation in Oklahoma who were murdered in the 1920s. Their deaths went ignored by law enforcement for years. The film is based on journalist David Grand's book of the same name, and David is helped in his research by members of the Osage Nation who had family connections to those deaths, including the current Osage chief, Jeffrey Standing Bear, whose great-grandfather was chief during that time. I spoke with David Grand and Chief Standing Bear in October when Killers of the Flower Moon, the film, was released. Here's our conversation. David, let's start by just getting some background here for people who don't know this story. What happened?
Yeah, so the Osage have been driven off over centuries off their ancestral lands, more than 100 million acres. And eventually they were confined to a reservation in northeast Oklahoma. Most whites had kind of considered this territory worthless because it was rocky and infertile. And the Osage thought, you know, a chief had stood up and said, you know, our people will be happy there because whites will finally leave us alone. And then it turned out that this land was sitting upon some of the largest reserves of oils than ever discovered in the United States. And each Osage on the tribal roll was given a headright, which was essentially a share in this mineral trust. And gradually, as more oil was tapped, their wealth grew until in the year 1923 alone, they received what will be worth today more than $400 million. And they become among the wealthiest people per capita in the world. And they lived in large houses. They had servants, some of whom were white. And then they began to die under these very mysterious and sinister circumstances. There were poisonings. There were shootings. There was even a bombing. And this period became known as the Osage Reign of Terror.
What was being done about the killings as they happened? Because they didn't happen all at once, as you say.
Well, many of the Osage were crusading for justice and going to the authorities with what evidence they collected, demanding investigations. And yet because of deep prejudice at the time, and because there was widespread corruption and complicity in law enforcement, these crimes were ignored. And even a few of those who dared to try to investigate the case or get help, they themselves were killed. There was one man who went to Washington, D.C., whom the Osage had sent to try to get federal authorities to look into these cases. He checked into a boarding house, and he had received a telegram from Oklahoma that said, be careful. And he left the boarding house that night, and he was abducted. And his body was found in a culvert the next morning, and he'd been stabbed and beaten to death. And a Washington Post headline said what the Osage had long already knew. It's a conspiracy to kill rich American Indians.
This was such a tragedy, Chief Standing Bear. It isn't just history for you and many other members of the Osage Nation. How were you taught about the time known as a Reign of Terror when you were growing up?
We were not talking about it. The people of my grandparents' generation were in their 20s and 30s and growing up in that time. We did know that they had fabulous wealth, wonderful cars, servants, even bought biplanes to fly around and have fake dogfights with each other. It was a time of immense wealth and also great tragedy. But we did not talk about it except little hints here and there when you overheard them talking to the elders to each other.
We hear and are learning a lot about in our country and yours too about intergenerational trauma, and stories sometimes weren't told because of that trauma, and as the term suggests, it's passed along. How is the trauma of that period still impacting families of the Osage Nation?
If I might illustrate this in the fact that of our 25,000 Osage people, about 5,000 or less live in our homeland now, even though this is a place where we said is our final home after being pushed from Missouri and through Kansas here. And of that 25,000 people, more than half do not even live in the state of Oklahoma. This exodus to this place needs to be replaced with an exodus of return, which is why we're working so hard here to build food sustainability, cultural sustainability, and to rebuild our language that took such a hit, not only in the 1920s with all the social disruptions, but prior to this in the 19th century, those federal policies of the United States government were often marked by brutality. So we are recovering again. And I think this time we must say we need to educate ourselves. We need to take care of each other to make sure this doesn't happen again.
And when I was doing the research, I interviewed people like the chief and many descendants of people who had suffered from that period. And one of the people I interviewed was a descendant of Molly Burkhardt, who is the center of my book and featured in the film, whose family is being systematically targeted. Her name was Margie. And when you talk to people like Margie and you talk to others and the chief, you know, when they tell you these stories and this history, I mean, Margie always said to me, you know, I didn't get to grow up with cousins because so many of her ancestors, her aunts or great aunts, were killed. And you realize that this is really living history. And I think it's important to understand that we are not talking about that long ago. We're really talking about recent history. We're talking about a century ago. And so this history still reverberates to this day. But I also think it's important to underscore, and the chief really made this point, and which is that history doesn't stop. And so we're obviously talking about these tragedies, but, you know, one of the things that always strikes me every time I visit the nation over the years is that it is such a vibrant nation led by the chief here. And, you know, they have their own constitution, their own Congress. They have found new forms of wealth. And I always think of this one quote that an Osage lawyer has actually told me when I was visiting with the dances, and actually the first time I met the chief, and she had told me, you know, we were victims of these crimes, but we don't live as victims today.
David, you mentioned Molly, one of the central characters of your book, Molly Kyle and her husband, Ernest Burkhart. They're played by Lily Gladstone and Leonardo DiCaprio in the film. Of course, these events affected so many people. Why did you choose to focus on that particular relationship? What did their experiences say that's so big?
Yeah, I mean, to me, no family was more brutally targeted than Molly's family, but that relationship was very representational on what transpired, what happened to Molly. Molly's story is really representational of what was happening broadly. And so you can really focus in on that story to tell the larger story. And Molly was really a remarkable woman. She straddled not only two centuries, but two civilizations. She very boldly crusades for justice when her family is being targeted, often putting a bullseye on her back. And ultimately, she is betrayed, and her betrayal by somebody whom she had loved or thought she had loved and whom she thought had loved her is indicative and gets to the very heart of this sin and this betrayal that took place for the Osage back in the early 20th century.
Chief Standing Bear, when Martin Scorsese got the rights to make Killers of the Flower Moon into a film, you spoke with him about some concerns you had. What was that conversation like?
David was introduced to our community by a respected elder, Catherine Redcorn, who was director of our museum. And she began to open doors. He stepped through there and in a respectful way found a conversation about this era and met with some of our elders who had kept records, who had good histories. And my role really did not come into significant action until I met Marty Scorsese, and he came in and said, we are going to film here among the Osage, which he had known was our big concern at the time. But as soon as he said that with such conviction, I immediately offered him access to all of our language people, all of our people who are familiar with our traditional clothes and so on. And then I assigned my chief advisor, John Williams, to be with Marty Scorsese as close as possible. He ended up having a chair, a director's chair, on set and set during the filming. And it's important that John's contribution be recognized because he has all the credentials. He's was the traditional drum keeper of the Gray Horse ceremonial drum. And then at the time of the movie, he was senior advisor to the Gray Horse ceremonies. So he also was a man who we relied upon for guidance, especially during this movie. He has since passed. He did see the first screening of the movie, thank goodness. And that's how that developed. It was through our people working with the team of Marty Scorsese. And it was not just one event, it was a process.
This might sound like an obvious question, but why was that so important?
Well, we have been stereotyped and it's being told our story by others besides us. And in this movie, I can tell you, and in the book, it took a deep cooperation with the Osage people to, as David will tell you, to write the book and to produce this movie. Our people were, as Marty says, not only in front of the camera as extras and others in the set and the ceremonies, etc., but we were behind the camera. Our younger people especially were able to work with world-class professionals in the film industry.
And so, David, when you were writing this book, you had to grapple with these things too, right? You're not Indigenous. You're also not from Oklahoma. So how did you reckon with that? This, you know, movies of the past, books of the past, these kind of tropes, the Pocahontases, the Dances with the Wolves that have sort of veered into white savior territory. How did you reckon with that as you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you, as a reporter and as a historian, by the very nature of what you do, you are an outsider. I don't write memoirs. I don't write about myself. And that involves always moral complications. And in a case like this, when you're writing about a deeply traumatic history, a history in which whites perpetrated crimes against members of the Osage Nation, white settlers did, you just have to be so conscious always of that. And then the way I approached it was just to try to be as transparent as possible, to express why I was there and to ask questions. And as Chief described, you know, I got to know, I would stay there for weeks and weeks and months each year. And I worked on it for more than half a decade. And over time, I just got to know, especially a lot of the Osage elders, and each one would then introduce me to another elder and they would share with me their story. And as a reporter and as a historian, what you're doing is you are documenting and recording. And that is really what I tried to do. And then as I did, to make sure I went over that documentation, that I got it right, and to check those facts. And as the chief also said, the book would not exist. I mean, it is a record of many, many oral histories and also documents and records that were entrusted with me. And my only hope when you do something like this is that you both earn the trust and you reward that trust with the, you know, with the final outcome.
I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. This is the Sunday Magazine, and I'm speaking with author David Gran and Osage Nation Chief Jeffrey Standing Bear about Killers of the Flower Moon. David's the author of the book by that name, and now it's been turned into a film by Martin Scorsese that tells the real story of death and betrayal in an Oklahoma Indigenous community. There will be many reviews of this film. There already have been some. Christopher Cote, an Osage language consultant, saw it, and he, quote, he had mixed feelings about it. He told The Hollywood Reporter that even though he believes Marty Scorsese did a great job representing the Osage people, he was conflicted about the sympathetic depiction of Ernest Burkhardt, who's the white man responsible for some of the murders. Chief Standing Bear, what do you make of that criticism? These are complex and complicated stories, but what do you make of that?
Well, Chris is a great talent, and he was deeply involved with the language preparation. When I first met Robert De Niro, he goes, "Do you know my language coach, Chris Cote?" Mm-hmm. And I go, "Yes, yes, I do." But Chris is, I think, expressing what many of our younger people are correctly expressing, is the story itself is something we haven't really, my generation, haven't really shared, talked about for a lot of reasons. We weren't there. We heard stories of our elders. And I can assure you, I'm married to an Osage. My children are Osage. Grandchildren are Osage. I don't talk to them about this until now. But I have noticed the younger people are mad about it, mad about the story. And it had to be told now that I see this happening, because it's a discussion that's long overdue. And interestingly, in Mexico City, just recently, I saw a journalist talking about this and asking me, like you are, of my views. And then they would say, "This story is familiar to us." And they're talking about their own indigenous population. And I just have to respond, "Well, that's something I need to study." So this discussion will continue for years.
Yeah. So many of the issues at the heart of Killers of the Flower Moon are experienced by many indigenous communities across North America. In our country, hundreds of indigenous communities still grappling with the intergenerational trauma from the abuses and deaths at residential schools. And there are protests over resource extraction. The construction of pipelines has created a lot of tension between communities and our governments and broader society. And so, Chief Standing Bear, you said, you know, when the young people say they're angry and maybe they don't know a lot of this, but they want what we here in our country refer to as reconciliation. When you hear that from the young people of your nation, what goes through your mind?
Well, first of all, when we talk about sovereignty, which is a big term for us, we understand there are two aspects of this. There is the external sovereignty, where we interface with local governments and the United States federal government. And that is a constantly shifting relationship. Then there's the internal sovereignty. Internal is where we define ourselves through our language and our culture and our territories, and we take care of each other within that time. And we learned this during the pandemic in March of 2020, when my staff came to me and said, "Chief, we have no meat." And our children programs and elder programs, there was just a complete shutdown of the food supply network. Now we have a meat processing plant. We have herds of bison and cattle. We built a new greenhouse. It's a 40,000 square foot greenhouse. So these are not small issues. We're going to take care of each other, and we have to. And that's what this is about. And so if we had that going in the 1920s, I think a lot of this tragedy could have been avoided. If we take responsibility for our own actions and not rely on the government and merchants, but take care of ourselves. That's the lesson for me in this story.
David, as part of the efforts at reconciliation, education is such a big component of that. And your book comes into play because, of course, as you well know, some Oklahoma teachers are concerned that a law passed in the state in 2021 regulating classroom discussion of race and gender could bar them from putting your book and this history in front of kids. Killers of the Flower Moon may not be on the curriculum. What does that say to you about the political landscape when teachers are fearful that they could face repercussions for assigning your book, teaching American students about their history, their collective history?
Yeah, I mean, one of the tragedies about this history early on was that it was initially distorted and then erased from curriculums. I mean, outside the Osage Nation, this wasn't taught, it wasn't learned. And now we are at this really pivotal moment when there is this opportunity, as the chief said, to really begin these conversations, to learn about our history. And yet, there is this law passed in Oklahoma, is written in this very vague way that has led some teachers to fear that they can't talk about this history or the Tulsa race massacre because they might lose their accreditation or their licenses. And I think that would just be a terrible mistake, because the truth is history shapes us no matter what. But if we ignore it, it festers, it distorts us, it creates grievances. And so the trick for us is to harness history and take from it and learn from it, both the stirring and the triumphant, but also the cautionary and the truth. And that's how we learn how to be the kind of people and nation we want to be. And so I think it's essential that this history be taught. I can't see why it shouldn't be. But I'd be really curious to hear the chief's thoughts on this.
In our small way, we have been building our own private school system. And there, the Osage language is primary as much as we can. And our traditions and culture are honored in ways we could not do in a public system. But that is our solution. And it's expensive, yes. And getting teachers is hard, especially in rural areas. But that is a way we believe we can continue a free and open discussion. You cannot keep important information secret forever. And the good things will last and continue, and there will be a record somewhere. Although lots may be lost. I was just, like I said, in Mexico City, I could not help but think about how much of their tribal historic record was lost, but there was so much kept. And that's how we do. There are sayings of our elders. Be good to one another, they say. Follow the drum. Put respect first. All these sayings are the sayings of the ancient ones. And we keep those important lessons close to us. We may have lost so much, but we keep what we can.
David, you spent years researching, working on this book, poring over those historical documents, interviewing families. But at some point, you put the book out into the world, and you stepped away for it, or at least you know, from the writing of it and putting it out there. How has, though, this all changed you, or has it?
You know, I think that when I worked on the book for all those years, you know, I really wasn't sure if people would read it. I didn't really know if it was the kind of history that, you know, people would be willing to read. And so I have been struck that people have received it and have read it. But the thing that was most important to me when I wrote that book was to address my own ignorance. I mean, and that's really how I go about life. I'm always just trying to address my own ignorance. And that's why I go from one project to another. And I was just shocked by how that I didn't know anything about this. And so when I worked on the story, I did that and hopefully tried to address, you know, the ignorance outside the Osage Nation. And now that there is a film, I think the real change is that this conversation now has a chance to grow. And Chief had said it will go on for years and years. And I think that's how history grows. You know, history to me is always a living organism. It is a dynamic process. It is not static. It is not defined in one book. It is not defined in a movie, no matter how great that movie it is. It grows through conversation, through new voices, through conversations like we're having now, for many other conversations that will hopefully take place, new records that will be found, new stories that will be heard. And to me, that is hopefully, I'm hopeful that will be the real change.
At the end of the book, there's a quote about the Osage Nation that really struck with me, and especially kind of in these messy times in our world. And the quote reads, as you both will well know, today our hearts are divided between two worlds. We are strong and courageous, learning to walk in these two worlds, hanging on to the threads of our culture and traditions. Chief Standing Bear, you talked about the teachings of your ancestors and that being passed on. When you hear those words, that quote, what does it make you think?
The same thing. That was well said. Our people really must turn to a higher authority, like we all should, for guidance. This is a lesson I've learned, and I'm thankful for it. And we have to find our strength all around us, as the elders would say. Everything you want to know is right in front of you. And we called Wanakhidali, the Holy Spirit. And I'm not trying to be religious to everybody, but they always talk about that power, those old folks. And I'm starting to get a glimpse of what they mean.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I say Uweno. Is that how I say thank you?
Wewena is
Wewena.
Now, they've been doing that more recently, shortcut. I know the men would say, Dali Wajoa, which means you did good.
Thank you both. I appreciate so much you both sharing your thoughts and for teaching us this history so many people didn't know. Appreciate you both. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Wewena.
Jeffrey Standing Bear is the principal chief of the Osage Nation. David Gran is the author of Killers of the Flower Moon, which Martin Scorsese adapted for his latest movie. It's up for 10 Oscars tonight. And that's it for this week on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. We had additional help from studio director Susan McReynolds. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.